that they can be used for clustering. So in our previous work for either supervised or unsupervised clustering, we assume that the number of clusters is known. But what if we're exploring a data set whose properties are unknown? We can experimentally optimize the number of clusters, but we've seen that this produces unpredictable results. In particular, most clustering algorithms will always give you better, lower distortion with the larger number of clusters that you use. So there's really no way to tell what the right number of clusters are. So typically what's done is to try to use some kind of information theoretic measure, some kind of statistical measure to determine the quality of the clusters so that you start trading off the number of clusters versus the quality of those clusters. A formal approach to this is to use some statistical technique like a chi-squared fit or Kolmogorov-Smirnov statistics or information theoretic measures like the Akeiki information criterion, to use these as measures of goodness. But these are not often tractable, and in practice, I haven't seen these be very useful for a number of signal processing problems. So the so we have sort of a basic question then. What if we know that we have that C+1 clusters are better than C clusters? What constitutes a statistically significant improvement in the number of clusters? How do we know that adding that one additional cluster is really giving us an improvement, or is it just in the statistical noise? So one way that people approach this is to use a hypothesis testing approach. Hypothesize there are C clusters. That represents what we call the null hypothesis. Compute the sampling distribution for the C+1 clusters under this hypothesis, and then estimate acceptance and confidence and such things so that we can ask ourselves with a certain level of confidence to what degree is the C+1 clustering better than the C clustering. So suppose we have a set D of N samples. Let us hypothesize the N samples come from a normal distribution with a mean mu and a identity covariance matrix. Identity times of some kind of variance. So in other words, the variance in all directions are equal and the features are uncorrelated. The sum of the squared error, which we'll call J sub E of 1, is a random variable because it depends on a particular set of samples. So we can write an expression for the overall squared error, J sub E of 1, as the sum over all the data of X minus mu, or X minus M squared, the norm or distance squared. And since the N samples came from a normal distribution, it can be shown that this expression for the error or for the distortion, J sub E, is approximately normal with the mean of N, the number of data samples, times D, the dimension of the feature vector, times sigma squared, the variance. And its variance is 2N times D sigma to the fourth. So suppose now we partition this set into two subsets, D1 and D2, so as to minimize the error, and that will give us then this J sub E of 2, representing two clusters instead of one cluster. And again, we can write that this J sub E, the error, is equal to the sum of the distances of each element of a cluster minus its mean, and then that's summed over each cluster. So we have two clusters, so we sum over each cluster, and we take the total distortion within that cluster. Now, what do we know? Generally, if our clustering algorithm is working well, what do we know about J sub E of 2 versus J sub E of 1? Just J sub E of 2 should be lower, right? And for most clustering, almost any reasonable clustering algorithm, that will be true. So the question is, how much lower must it be to make this two-cluster approximation better or more acceptable than the one cluster approximation. There's no analytic solution to this, but we can estimate a solution by considering a suboptimal partitioning in which the hyperplane passes through the mean. So for large N, the squared error for this partition is approximately, and this is the two partitioning where the hyperplane essentially splits these one class into two classes. So everything to one side of the mean goes in one class, and everything to the other side of the mean goes in a second class. So for large N, the squared error for this partition is approximately normal with a mean of N times the quantity D minus 2 over pi sigma squared, and the variance is 2 times N times D minus 8 over pi squared times sigma to the fourth. Now, the derivations of these things, I believe, are in the textbook. The derivations of this is a little bit tedious, but what I just want to sort of demonstrate today is the basic hypothesis testing formulation using these results. So J sub E of 2 is smaller than J sub E of 1 because the I'm just looking at that. I'm showing the means there, but actually the variance for J sub E of 2 will be smaller than, or the distortion will be smaller than the variance for J sub E of 1. So we can derive a hypothesis test based on these assumptions. We can reject the null hypothesis at the p% significance level if J sub E of 2 over J sub E of 1 is less than some threshold. So since J sub E of 2 is smaller than J sub E of 1, the ratio of those two should be less than 1. But the question is, how much less than 1 must they be such that this produces a statistically significant difference? Now, if you take these expressions for the variances of those, the mean value, I remember now what, let me back up here. Okay, so let's come back to here. Whoops. Let's come back to this for a second. So this mean is the mean of the distortion. It's the mean value of the distortion, not the mean value of the cluster. So if the mean value of J sub E of 1, remember we're modeling J sub E of 1 as a Gaussian random variable with some mean and some variance. If the mean value of J sub E of 1 is greater than J sub E of 2, then we would say that J sub E of 1 is larger than J sub E of 2. So what we're showing here is that the mean value of J sub E of 2, the expected value of the distortion for the two cluster system, is less than the expected value of the distortion for the one cluster system. So we have two clusters and one cluster. So we can derive a hypothesis test based on these assumptions, and again, we won't go through the details of that derivation, but you would expect the ratio of these two quantities. You would expect the ratio of these two quantities to be related to the means of those distributions and the variance of those distributions. And if you derive that, the result has kind of complicated looking form, 1 minus 2 over pi d minus alpha times this rather messy looking quantity, where alpha, this parameter here, alpha, is determined by this equally complicated expression. P is equal to this function, which we call a complementary error function. It involves the integral of a Gaussian from alpha to infinity. It's a rather common expression in statistics, and it essentially relates the confidence level. So what this is saying, if you're not familiar with how confidence level and hypothesis testing works, is that is that this result, if these two are less than a certain constant, so let's say let's say that the ratio of these two is 0.8, just as a concrete example. From that value, you can ask the question, well, since both of these are random variables and their ratio is 0.8, what we're trying to get at here is, what is the chance that that was actually true versus just a random event, statistical noise? Right? If you have two distributions with different means, two Gaussian distributions, and you randomly draw points from those Gaussian distributions, and if distribution 1 has a mean less than distribution 2, okay, so distribution 1 has a mean less than distribution 2, and I randomly draw points from these two distributions, will the points drawn from distribution 1 always be less than the points drawn from distribution 2? And the answer is no, because they're both Gaussians, and there's some probability that at some point you're going to draw, let's say, a large value from distribution 1 and a small value from distribution 2, and distribution 1 will be greater than distribution. So only as you draw lots of points will it become clear that on the average, distribution 1 is less than distribution 2. Well, the same thing applies here to this experimental to this hypothesis testing. The question is, if the distortion for the two clusters is less than the distortion for the one cluster, at what point does that difference become statistically significant? Well, the interesting thing about these hypothesis testings is you never get a yes or no answer, right? You always get an answer in terms of an amount of confidence, which is, I always kind of like that about statistics. They'll never tell you yes or no. They'll always tell you with some probability how truthful that is. And they'll leave it up to you to decide how much you want to bet on that probability, essentially. But that's okay. You want to ask the question, well, how confident do I want to be of that difference? And typically with signal processing systems, I would say we tend to operate at about the 90th percentile in terms of confidence. There's no hard and fast rule about this, but it seems like a lot of work is done at 90th or 95th percentile. So we want to be, let's say, 90% sure that this difference is significant. So what we do then is we take a value of 90% for P. We determine the corresponding value for alpha. We take that value of alpha and plug it into this equation, and then we can test whether the difference between these two clusterings is less than that corresponding value. Now, generally speaking here, since this ratio is proportional to 1 minus alpha, as you lower your confidence, what do you expect is going to happen to alpha? So if you lower your confidence to, let's say, 50% from 90%, what do you think is going to happen to alpha? Or what do you think is going to happen to this, to 1 minus alpha, this threshold here? So if this difference, if this ratio of JE2 to JE1 is close to 1, what does that tell us? No, if the rate... So JE2 is supposed to be better than JE1, right? Which means it has smaller error. So if the ratio is close to 1, what does that mean about the two-cluster model versus the one-cluster model? It's about the same. So for these two to be close, what does that mean about... So if this 1 minus... 2 over pi d minus alpha times this thing. If this is close to 1, what does that mean about the likelihood? Does that make it easier or harder to accept our hypothesis that two clusters is better than one? if this 1 minus, if it's hard to do this without the screen, but if this entire quantity here, so let's look at, let's maybe try to make this a little more concrete. Let's look at two cases. Let's assume that this is equal to 0.99 in one case. And it's equal to 0.5 in another case. Now, knowing nothing about statistics, which one of the two do you think is, which clustering, let's call this Joe's algorithm and Tom's algorithm. Which clustering algorithm do you think is better? Tom, right? Why? Right, right. And the difference seems to be significant, right? I mean, we would, that's a big difference between 0.99 and 0.5. So, if I had to ask you, how sure are you that Joe's clustering algorithm, that this is a statistically significant result, how would you reply? Again, knowing nothing about statistics per se, but just, if I were to tell you that these two algorithms, you know, that Joe's algorithm there gives you 0.99, which is a very small improvement, you would generally say, well, it's likely that that's just computational noise in the two algorithms. The second clustering is not significantly better than the first one, right? And if I said, well, how confident are you of that? You would likely say, well, I'm pretty confident. Whereas with the 0.5, you would say, well, it really does look like Tom's algorithm is good because the two cluster model seems to be much better than the one cluster model. So the question we want to ask is, well, how confident are you that in the case of Tom, that algorithm is better? For example, if the clustering was done on 100 data points, versus the clustering being done on 1 million data points, you would tend to trust the clustering on 1 million data points because there's more data and you would think you're getting a more statistically significant result. So we can quantify that the idea of confidence using this hypothesis testing approach. And hypothesis testing is a general technique that's used in statistics for just about any kind of experimental situation. The theory is in itself is based on some Gaussian assumptions of the random variables and things like that. But generally, you can, as we've done here, based on those Gaussian assumptions, you can usually derive some kind of hypothesis test. And there's always going to be one degree of, I don't want to use degree of freedom, but there's always going to be a key parameter, which is P, the confidence. Your confidence value, your significance level, meaning that you have, before I can tell you if these two results are statistically, if the difference between these two results are statistically significant, you have to tell me how confident you want to be in that decision. Now, if you tell me that I'll accept anything, confidence of 10%, you could be wrong 9 times out of 10 and I'm not going to worry. What is that going to do to this threshold or to the, how permissive is that going to be of the difference between these two clustering models? More permissive, which means the ratio is going to go closer to 1, right? So if you tell me, well, I'll settle for a p-value of 0.1, which is not very confident or not very, a low percentage of significance. You take that value, you compute alpha, you take alpha and you plug it into this expression. What you're going to find is that the overall threshold is going to be very close to 1. With very little difference between JE2 and JE1, you're going to get a statistically significant result because it's only a P of 0.1. It's only a 10% significance. Conversely, if you say, well, I want to be really confident, if you let P be 0.95, then the JE2 over JE1 is going to have to be much closer to something like this. The difference between the two is going to have to be much larger to be guaranteed that 95% of the time you're correct that these two results are statistically different. So, if you're not familiar with hypothesis testing, go back, take a statistics course, read some. We talked about this. I've talked about this in a few courses that I teach, but there's a lot of literature out there on that. I think there's probably even some links in these notes to those topics. But the point here, what we're showing here, is that we can actually tie the evaluation of cluster models to confidence in hypothesis testing. Okay. And that's exciting. So next, let's talk a little bit about problems that companies like Google face, the online clustering or real-time clustering. So we can define a term called the stability or the plasticity, and we can talk about the stability or plasticity dilemma. And that this is basically that cluster structures should be stable and should not undergo major reorganization with a new piece of data. Why is that important to us? If you visualize this, you know, you see your clusters and they're splitting up the space in some way, and a new data point comes in and everything rearranges itself. Why is that a bad thing, would you argue? Why? So what do we call this problem? You're not almost there. No. We've talked about some particular terms in this course. What is one of the fundamental problems in pattern recognition? If you had to boil down all of the problems in pattern recognition to one statement in my class, what would that be? What would my I've introduced early in the semester, and I've talked about this continuously, a particular concept that's related to this, which I consider to be the fundamental problem in pattern recognition. Something versus something. What you just described is exactly a slide I showed early in the semester, and I said, remember this slide. So we have on the one side the G word, generalization, and on the other side we have the R word. Risk, right? So what you just described is that a new data point comes in. If that data, so we know we have algorithms that are perfectly capable of modeling arbitrary data sets to perfection, right? That's one thing we've learned in this course. If you give me a data set and you tell me, here's the test set, here's the training set, I can give you a learning machine that will give you 0% error. Now, I know that coming into this course, you thought maybe that's what you were paying admission for, is to learn how to do that. But I hope in this course you've learned that's actually an uninteresting problem. You can always find a machine that can, for a particular data set, give you 0% error. And I think that's, you know, it's important to understand this because, like I say, many students come into this class or come into their graduate studies thinking their whole goal in life is to get 0% error on their faculty member's favorite data set. Right? I mean, I'm sure many of you have faced this. There's this one data set that they've been working on for 30 years and, you know, but that's an uninteresting problem. The question is, to what extent can that machine generalize to solve all problems of that class? So that when a new data point comes in, the machine is still valid. If the machine's overtrained, when that new data point comes in, it will readjust itself too much. So we're talking about the same thing with clustering. When that new data point comes in, you don't want your clusters to rearrange themselves. It's, for example, suppose you're mining Google for semantics, which is something we do in my field, and you've now trained on trillions of pages, and you think you've automatically derived all concepts that exist in web pages. You can sort web pages by sports, by news, by entertainment, you know, yada, yada, yada. It would be really unfortunate if you update your algorithm on yesterday's new web pages and your whole vision of the universe changed. Sports and entertainment were no longer the categories. It was, I don't know, three-legged horses or something. That would be really unfortunate. So you would hope that after you've processed all these pages, and of course Google does this, and the number of the semantic search engines are trying to do this so that you can do, ask things like, show me all the pages about sports that happened yesterday. So to do this, your clusters have to be stable over time. You don't want them to move too quickly. And that's what we call the stability plasticity dimension or dilemma. And clustering based on a global criterion like minimum mean squared error tends to reduce stability because it's going to try to take all the data and find the overall best clustering, and it's not going to care about the individual clusters changing much. So what's sort of emerged out of the learning community is a concept called competitive learning, which is generally a way to constrain clustering so that adjustments are confined to the cluster most similar to the current pattern. So as this new data point comes in, you're only going to adjust things in the neighborhood of data point and the cluster associated with that data point. You're not going to globally rearrange all of your clusters. And you might ask, well, to what extent can such an approach converge to kind of a globally good solution if you're only changing things sort of one cluster at a time? Well, remember that your data is going to come from all points. If you collect enough data, you're going to span the entire space. So with a few data points, it'll be this cluster, then it'll be this cluster, then it'll be this cluster. Eventually, you'll touch all the clusters. It just may not happen as quickly as if you were doing clustering with some kind of global criterion. And that's sort of, I think, one of the neat things about learning. That in the past and in many research environments, you're working with small data sets where a premium is placed on optimization for that particular data set. But when you transition to things like the internet, where volumes of data are being created every day and you have vast amounts of data, these kinds of incremental approaches can also work very well. You may have to process three orders of magnitude more data to get there, but hey, that's no problem because there's 10 orders of magnitude more data out there every day. So most of your clustering and these kinds of information retrieval systems are able to process, you know, enormous amounts of data on a daily basis, and these incremental approaches will work very well. And that's given rise then to this whole, to a field or a technology known as competitive learning. It's related to a decision-directed version of K-means. Let's let each d-dimensional pattern be augmented with bias term x0 equal to 1 and normalized to have length 1. Each of the C clusters is initialized with a random weight vector. And this approach is very commonly implemented with neural networks. So for each new pattern, only the output unit with largest activation is permitted to update its weight. And the weight vector is updated using a simple gradient descent type algorithm. The new value of the feature vector is equal to the old value plus some constant times the new data point. And then the weights are renormalized so that the weights still sum to 1. So this is an algorithm where you're essentially updating the weights of your neural network-based clustering scheme. You're only updating weights associated with a particular pattern. And the drawback of this algorithm is that's not guaranteed to converge, and it has the usual issues with gradient descent, the speed of convergence and the bias of convergence. But the benefit of this approach is that it will reach stability, and then as you're processing data incrementally, things will tend to change less than if you're trying to do some kind of global k-means clustering it with all the data at each point in time. So what happens if we must cluster in real time as data arrives? Well, this leads to what some people call the leader-follower clustering. Leader-follower clustering is after only the cluster center most similar to a new pattern, only the cluster center most similar to a new pattern, and then spontaneously create a new cluster if no current cluster is sufficiently close to the data. So this is sort of an interesting variant of competitive learning, because this is actually important in an application like mining the internet, because one of the problems you'll have with what we just described, the competitive learning approach, is some world event will happen, like cold fusion, right? And all of a sudden you're going to start seeing web pages on cold fusion that don't really fit any of the categories that you have previously defined, because it's a new concept. So you don't want to start merging that into this most similar cluster, because you'll lose the identity of that concept. Even though you might say, well, it belongs under my class called physics, but maybe you're clustering at a finer level than that. So what this does is it says, well, if that new data point is not sufficiently close to any one of my existing clusters, let me go ahead and start a new cluster based on that data point. And that way you can sort of evolve to adapt to and kind of follow new concepts. Of course, it's hard to do this in practice, because most likely you're going to start spawning lots of new clusters. But this is sort of a concept that has been developed to deal with emerging new data, dealing with data that emerges that doesn't really fit the previous data that you've seen. So the strategies, you know, are sort of standard. It's shown here in pseudocode, but the key step is essentially the step where we go ahead and add a new cluster if the data is not sufficiently close to any of the existing clusters. And invariably, you're going to have some parameter theta which controls this concept of, is it sufficiently close to an existing cluster? And determining the optimal value of that's a challenge. Making that independent of the cluster, making that independent over time, you know, there's all those kinds of issues. But I think from a conceptual level, this is a pretty simple approach. So leader-follower clustering is an example of a family of approaches known as adaptive resonance theory. And these typically use self-organizing neural networks. The network has both top-down and bottom-up weights. The bottom-up weights learn the cluster centers. The top-down weights learn the expected input patterns. So you see in this schematic here, you have these bottom-up weights, sort of our standard neural network. And then you also have top-down weights, which go back from the higher levels to the lower levels. So the bottom-up weights represent a standard clustering approach that's based on neural networks. But the top-down weights our sort of verification that particular input patterns should be associated with particular clusters. So the top-down signals provide additional input to the bottom layer. The top-down feedback pushes the responses of the bottom layers closer to W, which in turn stimulates the top more strongly, which in turn stimulates the input. So this network, because it's got this loop, has this ability to do what's called resonate. And then, therefore, what this network tries to do is, as the network is allowed to create new clusters, so the idea is that as you iterate on the with reestimating the equations, you've got these kinds of loops now. This network will sort of resonate with the data, and then as new data comes in, if that new data does not adequately match the state of the network, then you have to do something to enable new clusters. You could, for example, create a new state and connect it to all the other states, and then let that state update. Adaptive resonance, this is another sort of broad area of in the statistics literature that's a fairly new area. And the neural network approach to this kind of represents one particular implementation to this, but it falls in this family of sort of leader-follower clustering. Now, the next, sort of pushing this one step further, we've talked about how you can represent, the top is cut off there. So we've talked about how one of the ways you can view clustering is you can take all your data and compute a similarity matrix, every data compared to every other piece of data. The diagonal of that similarity matrix should be zero because that's one data point compared against itself. And then all the off-diagonal elements represent the degree to which this data, the data differ. Now, you can view that, you can view clustering then, when you think of the similarity matrix, you can view clustering then as a problem in representing this matrix. And if you think about clustering as the process of connecting data that's similar, you could think about clustering as searching this matrix and trying to find data points which are similar and then establishing some connection with them. So you can overlay a graph on this matrix that describes which data points are close to which and which data points are far away from which. So that leads you to this idea that you can actually think about clustering as a graph theory problem. And you can look at the properties of the graph describing the similarities in the data, and you can manipulate the properties of that graph to achieve certain types of clustering phenomena or certain types of clustering. So as a simple example of that, we can pick a threshold and we can decide if Xi is similar to Xj if the distance between, if the similarity between those two points is greater than this threshold. This matrix then induces a similarity graph in which nodes correspond to points and an edge joins node I and node J if and only if Sij is greater than zero. The clusterings produced by single linkage algorithms like this and by a modified version of the complete linkage algorithm can be described in terms of the similarity graph. There's many graphical methods designed to represent the similarity graph with reduced complexity. That's essentially what clustering is. It's taking all these data points with all these connections, and it's producing a graph that is much similar in terms of a smaller number of clusters or a smaller number of states. So you can think about this as you've got your clusters, and those are connected to all the data points through a graph. With a single linkage algorithm, two samples are in the same cluster if and only if there exists a chain X through X prime such that X is similar to X1, X1 is similar to X2, and so forth. Single linkage is a concept that's become very, very popular with analyzing people's internet behavior. This is sort of the 6 degrees of separation. I don't know if you've ever played this game. There's a popular game on the internet called The 6 degrees of Separation from Kevin Bacon, but Kevin Bacon's an actor who has been in a lot of kind of interesting movies, and one of the games is that everybody in the world seems to be connected to Kevin Bacon with no more than 6 steps. It's really kind of a very, very interesting little game, and actually there's been a very famous book published called Link, which talks about this phenomenon on a much larger level, and now people talk about social networks. You go on to places like MyFace and Facebook and MySpace, and you look at people's friends networks, and you look at how those intersect other people's friends networks, and you can learn all sorts of really, really interesting things about people. That's essentially what this is doing. It's establishing similarity through a chain. If you're friends with someone, and I'm friends with someone, you and I must be similar because we're friends with the same person. It's that kind of a concept. So with a complete linkage algorithm, all samples in a given cluster must be similar to one another, and no sample can be in more than one cluster. So that's a stricter criteria for clustering things. A nearest neighbor algorithm can be viewed as an algorithm for finding a minimum spanning tree. And we talked the last lecture about what the general concept of what a spanning tree meant. Other clustering algorithms can be viewed in terms of these graphs. And a figure of merit for such graphs is the edge length distribution. So this is simply acknowledging that we can think of even things like k-means clustering in terms of graphical models placed on top of the similarity matrix. And then you can actually build, you could, for example, think of a hidden Markov model as the hidden states become the clusters. And in fact, that's what people do when they do things like latent semantic analysis, where you try to take data and you try to find the underlying structure that's shared by all of that data. Yeah, so I think let me stop there today, because now we're going to talk a little bit about feature space and how you can reduce, how you can sort of perform nonlinear transformations on the feature space, and then we'll proceed to talk about multidimensional scaling and a few variants of this kind of thing. So we'll stop. I think we'll kind of stop here today.